All right, let's begin. So, this is the last lecture in the series, and we're just going to cover some of the big themes. We're going to talk about those issues that are going to hopefully resonate in other courses that you take, and we're going to revise and prepare for next week's exam. Now, one thing that's important, I'll say it at the start, next week, because the exam is an hour and a half long, and the slot is an hour and a half long, we're going to begin at 10 o'clock. So if you turn up late and you only just arrive in time, or if you don't arrive in time for the start of the exam, then you won't be allowed to do it, and you'll get a zero, or whatever, not the zero, that's really good in this system, isn't it? I forget how the marking works. Like five is really bad, right? You'll get a five. Okay, beware. So turn up on time, you'll get your exam script, and we can get started in good order and be out of here at 11:30. Okay, so the big picture, I want to dwell on this a little bit because I think it's important. We've been delving into the details of individual texts, but this course goes far beyond being able to read a tiny little bit of the West Saxon Gospels or anything like that. In fact, on a purely practical level, you now have the tools to read basically any English text ever written. And if that doesn't kind of strike you as something pretty amazing, then it should. This is impressive stuff. Now, I'm not saying you can automatically fluently read Old English. It would be foolish to expect that. What I am saying is you now know how to approach texts like this. If you've been paying attention, you've got the tools, you know where the dictionaries are, you can look things up, you can understand the paradigms, you can understand the structure of the language, and you can get a sense for what's going on in these texts. So that's useful from all kinds of perspectives, historical, literary, and everything else. But that's sort of on the purely practical side. You also have an understanding, or should have an understanding, of where present-day English came from. And we've been focusing on mostly British English, because before the early modern English period, that's really all there is. After the early modern period, English expands. And what we don't have in this course is any coverage of, for instance, the myriad of world Englishes that are spoken. Varieties of English have only been covered very briefly in general. So how does American English differ from Australian English? And how does Scots differ from the English spoken in places like Wales and Cornwall? All of these are interesting questions, and if you take courses in modules such as Varieties of English, in future you will find out more about them. That's one of the pathways that you can pursue as part of your course here in Constance. Taking a step back, you should also have a deeper understanding of language change than you did before. What is language change and how it works? We've talked about internal factors, and I'm going to reiterate some of these. Regular sound change, grammaticalization, and on the external side, language contact and prescriptivism. So you should all know now where English fits into the big picture, and we talked in lecture two about exactly where English comes from, about its roots and about its relatives. So here is the family tree for Indo-European. All of these languages descended from Proto-Indo-European, which, if you'll recall, there is some controversy about. There's some controversy about where and when exactly it was spoken. But the answer is a long time ago, somewhere quite a long way east of here. And the Germanic tribes made it as far as the very western edge of Europe. And we have all of these Germanic languages down here as the closest relatives of English. We've got the North Germanic languages up here. These are essentially the Scandinavian languages. We've got East Gothic, which died out, and then we've got the closer relatives down here, Old English, Old Dutch, Old High German, Frisian, and Low German, and Modern English, all of which might make it surprising that English is actually as different from German as it is. And that is because of the various changes that have taken place that we're going to talk about now. So first of all, there's regular sound change. English shows these systematic correspondences in its lexicon, in the sound structure of its lexicon, with the other Germanic and Indo-European languages. Recall we talked about Grimm's Law again in Lecture 2. We talked about the correspondence where Germanic F, Th, and Ch corresponds to, in other Indo-European languages, for instance, Latin, P, T, and K. This is illustrated, for instance, by words for father, like Vater in German, father in English, in Latin, Pater, with a P, which we have in borrowings in English too, such as paternal, patriarch. We have Greek and Latin borrowings which show this P sound for an initial F in Germanic. That's a change that happened in the prehistory of Germanic. And if you'll recall, it's one of the three features that sets Germanic apart from the other Indo-European languages, along with the stress shift to first position and also the dental preterite, the D form in the past tense, or T. Why do we find these correspondences? Well, because sound change is regular. This seems to be the most robust empirical generalization about language change ever discovered. And the crux of it is that words don't really change in their pronunciation. Sounds change in their pronunciation, and any words in which those sounds are contained are affected. Its morpheme structure or word structure is irrelevant. So this is something very striking. It's a very striking finding about language change that's not intuitive. Obviously, these sound changes only happen at a given time, at a given place, but when they do happen, they happen without exception. There has been debate about this principle. It's still widely accepted, but there are interesting details to be hashed out even now, and study of language change in progress can shed light on what's going on with the regularity of sound change. So if you're interested in future modules, looking at language change in progress is very much the domain of sociolinguistics. If you take modules in historical linguistics, you'll find out more about things like the regularity of sound change in general, how language change progresses in general. All of those ought to be available to you in future years. Both of those are unified by trying to understand how language changes. So not purely the synchronic structure of language, as you will be mostly exploring if you take modules like syntax, semantics, phonology, but the diachronic development. Another thing that we've seen throughout the course is a difference, a development from synthetic to analytic. So recall basic definitions. Synthetic language is one in which grammatical relations, so these are things like subject and object, and also semantic features, are marked by morphological endings. So typically, synthetic languages will use things like case and subject-verb agreement to mark these semantic or grammatical features. And so these languages will have a higher morpheme-to-word ratio. In other words, there will be words with many morphemes in this language. The average word will have a lot of morphemes. An analytic language is the opposite of that. Grammatical features and relations and semantic features are marked more by how the sentence is put together than by the content of the words themselves. So word order, for instance, subject, verb, object, will be a marker of what the grammatical relations are. You know what the subject is and the object by looking at the order of the sentence. Also, looking at grammatical words. So, for instance, prepositions and pronouns help to spell out what these grammatical features are, what these semantic features are. So what's the subject? You don't necessarily leave it unexpressed in a language like this. You express it overtly as a pronoun. These languages then have a lower morpheme to word ratio because morphology is doing less work. You can generally think of this synthetic to analytic dichotomy as synthetic languages relying more on the morphology, analytic languages relying more on the syntax to convey the meaning. And English has become more analytic over its history. That much, at least, is unquestionable. So here's an example of the synthetic to analytic shift. This is one you've seen before. It's from Sanskrit on the one hand, developing into Hindi-Urdu. So in the first example, you've just got three words, city, forest, goes, and it means he goes from the city to the forest. How do we get that meaning? Well, we get it from the different cases. The ablative case, which is this at marker on city, this shows us that we're dealing with from the city. And goes, this verb has a T suffix, and this shows that the subject is third person singular. If you've got that suffix, you don't need a pronoun to determine that the referent is third person singular. So that's Sanskrit. If we look at the Hindi equivalent of the same sentence, we've got all kinds of extra words in there. He, city from, forest to, go is. So here the case endings on words like city and forest have been lost. We've lost this ablative and accusative case marking. Instead, what we can see is that prepositions have been added into the sentence. So the prepositions from and to have been added in to make explicit what was formally expressed by case endings. We also see other new words appearing. So there's a form of the auxiliary that comes in here. There is also a pronoun, the pronoun he. So this pronoun he is inserted to mark the subject. And this is all part and parcel of becoming an analytic language. So becoming an analytic language is not something that just occurs in English, it's something that happens across many Indo-European languages and much more broadly as well. So, what changes in the history of English? What sort of changes illustrate the development from synthetic to analytic? Well, as you'll recall, Old English has these paradigms, these big tables of endings for both nouns and verbs, which hopefully you will remember. These will be on the exam, the relevant paradigms for Old English, so that you don't have to remember the endings, but you do have to remember how to use these paradigms and how they work so that you can look things up in the exam to answer the questions. So this case system disappears. English nouns aren't marked for any kind of case at all. It also disappears in adjectives. The only place it doesn't entirely disappear is in the prepositions. The prepositions remain, in the pronouns, not in the prepositions. In the pronouns, the case system remains, but even there, it's very limited. You've got an opposition between nominative and then some other case that you might want to call objective or oblique. It seems to be performing the roles of both accusative and dative. And then some sort of genitive or possessive pronoun. So there's very little of the case system left in present-day English. And what there is doesn't work in quite the same way as it used to. Remember the examples that we discussed in the last couple of lectures, between you and I, or me and John went to the shops. Cases in situations where you wouldn't expect to see them if you're looking at the system from a German perspective or from an Old English perspective. So we see more use of prepositions. That's what we saw on the previous slide. This is what happens in the transition from Sanskrit to Hindi as well. More use of prepositions. We see that verbal agreement with the subject is very heavily simplified. All that's left of it is an S ending in the third person singular in the present day language. And some varieties have even leveled that out. All of this shows development towards analytic. And in place of these verbal inflections, and in place of some of the prefixes that we see in the earlier language, we also find more use of modals and auxiliaries. So the modals and auxiliaries in English develop into a separate class. And probably in Xi 1, you will have already covered the special properties of modals and auxiliaries that set them apart from regular verbs in the English language. Expression of the subject becomes obligatory. So in earlier English, you could leave the subject out in certain contexts. You can't anymore in modern English. Subjects have to be there. It's one of the number one rules of English. The word order becomes less flexible. So SVO becomes the default. In Old English, you had more flexibility to structure your clause in terms of information, in terms of given versus new, focus versus background. The freedom was greater. And you also, on a more micro scale, you can see this development in comparatives. So comparatives with more and most, superlatives with most, partially replace the er and the est suffixes. So you can see that this is a more analytic construction because you're using words, separate words together in a specific order to mark your grammatical relations and no longer a special ending. But this only works for, this only happens in multi-syllable words. So for instance, just now I said more analytic. In earlier English, in Old English, the equivalent would have been something like analytica with an er ending. We don't see that anymore. That was a terrible example, by the way, because analytic is quite a late borrowing in the history of English. Any multisyllabic word, any word at all in Old English would have taken an er suffix or an est suffix to mark comparative or superlative. Okay, so we've got this wonderful development of synthetic to analytic. One of the questions then would be why? Why does this language become so analytic? One of the classic assumptions or claims that's been made is that this is a result of the stress shift. So in Germanic, the stress shifts to the first syllable, and that means that all of the endings in the language get weakened because they're no longer stressable. So these endings get weakened and then they disappear. That's all very well, but if you think about the Germanic language family, this stress shift affects all of them, and the development from synthetic to analytic has clearly gone further in languages like English than it has in languages like German or Icelandic, which have all undergone this same stress shift. So the stress shift can only be part of the story. It might be an important part of the story, but it can only be part of the story, especially since when we look at what was on the previous slide, Sanskrit developing into Hindi-Urdu, this did not undergo the Germanic stress shift. So it seems like the stress shift is neither necessary nor sufficient for the development into a more analytic language. What else can we look at then to try and explain this? Well, one classic idea is that language contact is responsible. The reason that English develops in such a specific way is because of the language contact that it's had during its history. And then this issue becomes a kind of murder mystery. It's a sort of whodunit. Who murdered the English case system, right? And then, you know, who do we blame? We've got lots of people we could blame. We could blame Latin speakers, we could blame Vikings, we could blame the Celts. We could blame the Anglo-Normans. There's many people who we could, in principle, lay the blame at the feet of. But who really did it? Who's really responsible? And to understand this, you have to understand a little bit more about language contact. There's a very interesting proposal by Peter Trudgill, and the reference I've given you is at the end of the slide. He suggests that actually contact with Celtic was responsible for the loss of the case system. Others suggest that the more important contact situation was with Norse, with Scandinavian. But this remains a debated issue in the literature. Now, as with all big ideas, there are some small-scale problems with this one. So we can start with the fact that Old English wasn't a completely synthetic language. In a sort of completely paradigm synthetic example, you can do whatever you like with your words, you can put them in any old order, and anything goes, and you can just mess them around, and you'll still be able to recover the meaning because there's so much morphology. Actually, when you look at Old English, it's not 100% synthetic. There are rules. This is more or less a verb second language. We talked quite in depth about the verb second property in lecture 4. So this isn't a language where literally any word order is possible. It's also not a language with a whole load of cases. Remember we saw in Sanskrit there was an ablative case, a case that means specifically from. If you look at other languages, languages like Finnish and Basque, they really go nuts with their case systems. They do absolutely everything with cases. But Old English gets by with four, sometimes five, sometimes an instrumental, but mainly four. And that's not really enough if you want to be a full-scale synthetic language. Similarly, referential subjects, if you want to refer to a person or a thing, he, she, it, that thing, you have to pretty much express the subject. There are a few instances where you can leave it out, and there are certain varieties where you seem to be able to leave it out more frequently. I've done some research on this myself. It seems like in older texts, for instance, the subject is left out more often. However, on the whole, referential subjects do need to be expressed. What is left out in English, what can be left out, is non-referential subjects, subjects of verbs like to seem. So it seems that. That it can be left out. The other it that can be left out is the it in sentences like it is raining, or it rained so heavily at the weekend that all of the water came through the ceiling of the G building and trashed people's offices, for instance. Hypothetical scenario. So referential subjects basically have to be expressed in Old English, which is not quite what you'd expect from a fully synthetic language. Similarly, verbs never agreed for person in the plural. It's not the case that you have different first person, second person, and third person forms. If you look at the paradigms, you can see that they're always expressed the same way, regardless of the tense, the mood, or anything else. Verbs are not distinguished for person in the plural. So Old English is not exactly the perfect synthetic language. It's a heck of a lot more synthetic than modern English, but it's not as synthetic as you can get. It's certainly, if you compare it to a language like Navajo, it looks relatively analytic. At the other end of the spectrum, when you look at modern English, this is not a completely analytic language. This is not a language where word order is completely fixed. You can still topicalize things. So normally remember that the word order in English is subject, verb, object. But you can also have other word orders. So for instance, if you're trying to contrast two options, someone will say something like, someone asks you a question, you like beans and carrots, don't you? And you can respond, well, beans I like, but carrots I hate. Well, you've got the object in initial position. This is an object-subject-verb structure. This is still possible in modern English, and there's nothing, weird or ungrammatical about it. It's a perfectly productive part of the language's strategy for expressing information. It's just not the default word order. But it does show that there is some flexibility. The other thing is that there are certain developments, particularly during the last period of the language, during the modern period from 1700 to the present, that turn the language slightly more synthetic. And that is, contractions develop. So nt, for instance, nt develops from the word not. That's fairly straightforward. But it develops in ways that are actually fairly unpredictable. So some of them are predictable. If you think of would versus wouldn't, should versus shouldn't, these are sensible pairs. But what about will and will not? Will versus won't, right? How is won't a predictable contraction of willn't? It isn't. So similarly, do versus don't with an O. Not do versus don't. So these contractions make the language actually more synthetic, because what they're effectively doing is turning what used to be a separate word into a piece of morphology. It's what's called grammaticalization, which I believe we're going to talk about on the next slide. So we've got this tendency that is seemingly bringing a few more synthetic languages back into the synthetic elements back into the language. And the textbook talks briefly about these as well. Overall, though, we're still dealing with a robust tendency. We're still dealing with a tendency for a language to become more analytic over time. Are there any questions? Told you to come with questions. No one listens to me. So, grammaticalization. Grammaticalization is a process which turns things from lexical to grammatical, which is kind of implicit in the name, right? Grammaticalization. This is what the process is. It will also cause more independent items to become more dependent. And that, for instance, we can see in the development of things like not into nt and will into ull in constructions like I'll, he'll, we'll, with an apostrophe in the written form. So those are a few examples of grammaticalization. We've got more on the slide here. The prepositions for and till become complementizers. For becomes a complementizer that marks non-finite clauses. So if you think of a sentence like, it is a good idea for you to revise thoroughly, this for introduces the non-finite clause, you to revise thoroughly. And if you remember your constituency tests from SHE 1, you ought to remember that you ought to be able to demonstrate that this clause, for you to revise thoroughly, is a single constituent. Till, similarly, till starts out as a preposition. You can say something like till Monday, and that becomes a complementizer as well. Till you have done your exam. For instance, this till, where does it come from? Anyone remember what language this till originates in? Yeah? Old Norse, yes. This is a Scandinavian borrowing. Quite a rare example of a language borrowing a grammatical item. We've also got verbs. We've got verbs like have, be, will, and do developing auxiliary-like properties. For some of these properties are incipient in the history of in the very earliest stages of Old English. But the process isn't complete until the modern period. And we can see various rather odd properties of these auxiliaries that set them apart from lexical verbs. The main thing is they don't actually contain the lexical meaning of the original. So if I say, for instance, I have a remote control, that's possession. I physically possess this remote control, at least for now. Right? That's what have means. But if you say something like, I have gone to the shops, that have does not have anything to do with possession. This is a purely auxiliary. It's just used to form the perfect. So this is a development from a more lexical item with a more concrete meaning to something that has a more abstract grammatical meaning. And this is exactly what grammaticalization is. Similarly, the preposition like, which we talked about last time, that becomes a discourse marker. And that, again, is an instance of grammaticalization. Negation, the development of negation, the development of the word not, is actually a sequence of grammaticalization events. If you want to find out more about grammaticalization, there is this textbook by Hopper and Traugott that you can look at. And one thing to note is that grammaticalization, when it repeats itself, leads to cycles, cyclical change. things that happen in the history of languages over and over again. So here is the negation example in more detail. You've seen a version of this slide before, but this one is different because it has a picture of Otto Jespersen on it. There he is. Look at his little glasses. Isn't that cool? Okay. So in Old English, remember, you've got this preverbal ne. You negate a sentence by putting a ne before the verb. In Middle English, you've got a new postverbal negator. So here we've got an example from Middle English, Saulus Warde. Because of all his strength, we dread we nawicht. This nawicht is an item that starts out meaning not one whit, not one tiny little bit. And it develops, it gets crushed down into a single word, and that is the process of grammaticalization, the first process of grammaticalization here. Nawicht, not a bit, becoming nat or not or nocht. That's the first development. And then you'll see in Middle English, just like in Standard French, this ne is still present before the verb. Later in Middle English, that negator is lost. So for instance, in Chaucer, you don't tend to see it. In Chaucer, you just get not or nat. So here we've got an example. He may not weep. He may not weep. This change is called Jespersen's cycle. And what's cool about it is that it happens in language after language after language. So Jespersen pointed out that it had happened in a few languages that he was familiar with. Since Jespersen's time, it's been documented in many, many more. And these are just a few examples from around the world. We've got examples here from Africa, from Asia, from South America, everywhere. This is a very widespread change. If you want to find out more about this, take a course in historical linguistics. I'm happy to go on about this at great, great, great length. Okay, what about contact? Well, remember this slide we've seen a couple of times before. These are very approximate timings. These are not sort of fixed dates. It's not like suddenly it's 750, Latin just disappeared off the face of the earth, and then it came back again in 1066. But these are rough time periods. If I was better at using OpenOffice, I would put little shading bits on the end of these boxes just to illustrate how vague and fuzzy they are. But these are the rough time spans in which these languages come into contact. Another comment that's worth making when you look at a slide like this is that not all contact is the same kind. The contact with Greek, for instance, that is happening in between 1500 and 1900-ish, this isn't anything like what happened with the Vikings, right? It's not that a bunch of Greek people suddenly came over in boats and started raiding our monasteries, right? And then they didn't start settling, right? This is a much more distant kind of contact, a much more learned kind of contact. And those differences in contact scenarios make it clear that different influences can be expected from different languages. I've just given you a few key dates here that it's worth remembering in any case for the history of English. So first of all, you've got 449, which is when English was born, if you want to give English a birthday. This is when the Anglo-Saxons arrived on the British Isles, or roughly around then. We don't actually know that it was 449. But 449 is a nice date. 1066, you all know about anyway. 2017 is today, the present day. And those are probably the three most important dates in the history of the English language. Well, 2017 isn't important, except for us. So you can see these various different influences. And the ones that have been the biggest are the first four, I would say. Latin, Celtic, Norse, and French. Greek has a lexical influence. We also get lexical influx from languages of the former British Empire and other kinds of influence of various types today. But the biggest influences come from those four. So contact, when we talk about language external factors, contact is the big one. This is the one where we think Well, look, the socio-historical situation of the language made it unavoidable for this kind of thing to happen. You know, history took English and took Norse and Celtic and sort of forced them together. And that is going to leave linguistic traces. So the interesting question is, do different types of contact lead to different types of change? Again, this book by Trudgill I would thoroughly recommend. If you click on that link on Ilias, you can get an interview that I did with Peter Trudgill talking about this book if you want the brief audio version. Again, you can listen to it in the bathtub if you like. In the history of English, what contact influences do we see? So, Celtic, heavily debated. Celtic is the language about which we know the least of all of these, because it's the furthest back in time and the least well documented. We do know that it didn't have a huge lexical influence. It had a few terms borrowed in specific areas, but particularly during the Old English period, Celtic doesn't seem to have had a huge lexical influence. There aren't many borrowings from Celtic. On the other hand, its grammatical influence may have been quite extensive, and this is again something that's quite heavily debated. It's a lively research question. Again, if you're interested in it, there might be modules for you to take in future where we can talk about this more. There are potentially some very major effects here, but the nature of them is still a matter of some dispute. Latin and Greek are in a way the opposite, because if there was Celtic influence, it would have been a different kind. Celtic would have been a very low prestige language, but there would have been a lot of Celtic speakers around. If we think about Latin and Greek, these were very high prestige languages, but there were almost no real native speakers of these languages actually around. So here we see huge amounts of lexical influence, a large proportion of the vocabulary of the language, especially in more technical areas, especially as soon as you go out of the core sort of central grammatical domain of basic vocabulary, you start getting these massive lexical influences. What about Scandinavian or Norse? Well, that seems to be found throughout the language. There are syntactic instances of borrowing, not so much in the area of morphology, perhaps, but certainly it looks like Norse borrowings had an effect on the phonology of the language, reintroducing clusters like sk, sk in writing, sk, which remember in Old English had become sh, through palatalization. We see syntactic changes, we see lexical influence, including basic vocabulary. So Norse-influenced contact-induced change does seem to be relatively pervasive. Again, it's disputed just how pervasive, but it's clearly relatively pervasive. Probably more so, the contact with Norse is likely to have been the most influential. This is likely to have been the most influential contact scenario in the history of English. Anglo-Norman then, also a contender for the most influential language, certainly it has enormous lexical effects. It introduces a huge number of words into the language. And later continental French, when that shifts to being the prestige language. So huge lexical effects, some phonological effects. It's sometimes said that the opposition between voiced and voiceless phonemes in fricatives, so the difference between f and v and s and z, was something that was introduced under the influence of Anglo-Norman, perhaps through the borrowing of so many words for which these contrasts were essential. On the other hand, we see almost nothing in the way of syntactic effects from this contact. It seems to be a certain type of population setting, probably related to the fact that there ultimately weren't that many of these Anglo-Norman speakers, but they were very, very influential. This is a slide that I skipped over last time I presented it. I wanted to come back to it because I think it's quite important from a general perspective. If you look at chapter 5, section 7 of the book, it provides an overview of this little debate. So the question is Middle English a Creole? Well, obviously, to answer that question, you need to know what a Creole is. And there is a box here which tells you roughly what a Creole is. But when we talk about Creoles, typically we're not talking about sort of the familiar languages of Western Europe. We're talking, for the most part, about languages that developed in the context of slavery, particularly in the context of slaves who were taken from countries in Africa to work on plantations. Now, what was special about these scenarios linguistically? Well, the slaves were taken from different countries, they spoke different languages, and the slave masters did not want them to be able to communicate with each other because slaves who can communicate with each other are dangerous, right? It's much easier to have stupid slaves who can't talk to each other and who just have to basically follow along on their own. You know, it's a divide and conquer strategy. So you've got these slaves who couldn't communicate with each other because they spoke different languages. They were taken to places where they would, the language that they were most commonly in contact with was the language of their colonial masters. So these are languages like English, French, Spanish, Portuguese. And they learned to communicate with one another. And to communicate with one another, they would use something that is called a pidgin. Pidgin is defined, I should write it down because it's not spelt like the bird. There you are, it's nice and big, so you can even see it on the camera, I hope. Pidgin. This is a contact language developed for the purposes of communication that has no native speakers. So no one speaks this as a native language, it's purely a tool for communication. A Creole, on the other hand, is a language that is developed when people start acquiring this pidgin as a native language. So children will acquire, if you think about the second generation of slaves in these plantation settings, they will develop a language based on what they hear around them from their parents. That will be, to a large extent, this pidgin, which is based on words from those colonial languages like French and English and Spanish. But when those children acquire a pidgin, it becomes a Creole. A Creole is a contact language with native speakers. So that's all well and good. And I've just presented in 2 or 3 minutes what is essentially a much more complicated story. But how does this relate to the history of English? Can we say that English is in fact a Creole under these circumstances? Well, there have been scholars who have argued that this is indeed the case. So for instance, work by Patricia Poussa has argued that English is a Creole based on Scandinavian. Work by C.J. Bailey and Carl Marolt has argued that English is a Creole based on Anglo-Norman, right? French, essentially. Work by others, including Hildegard Tristram, has come relatively close to arguing that English is actually a Creole based on Celtic. So there are all kinds of ideas out there about Creole properties. What's important here is that I think it's safe to say that none of these ideas has become mainstream. Obviously, there's a socio-political element to these arguments as well, as there often is. If you're saying that English is a Creole, what you're really saying is that this language is a kind of cuckoo in the nest, right? There's this sort of, that in fact, Old English sort of failed to make it, Old English died out, and that this language that we have today is actually not descended from it, is actually something else, some other kind of creation, some new language. And And, you know, if you're someone who's very traditional and very keen on emphasizing the pedigree of the good old British language, oh, yes. You know, if you're that kind of person, then you don't really, you know, it's not very, very appealing, this idea that Middle English is a Creole. But even if you're not that kind of person, what you ought to do probably is look at the facts objectively and say, is there a similarity, is there a socio-historical similarity between the events of which gave rise to the Creoles of the world today and the events of medieval England? And furthermore, is there a linguistic parallel between between Creoles and English? And in some respects, it's been argued that there is. English looks like a very analytic language, as we discussed before. Creoles typically are also very analytic. They have very little in the way of complex morphology. That at least has been claimed. Some people dispute that. Some people would say that there isn't even any such thing as a linguistic Creole type. What we can say about the history of English is that if we look at the contact effects that we talked about on the previous slide, these don't seem to be anything like on the same scale as what we see with Creolization. Yes, English had a major influence, but we can still trace a decent proportion of its vocabulary straightforwardly back to Old English by regular sound change. We can still trace a lot of its syntactic properties, actually, back to Old English. On the whole, the hypothesis that English is a Creole is not particularly widely accepted. Are there any questions? Yeah. So that would be arguing that Old English is a Creole. You could argue that. I think typically, so for the people who think that English has Creole features, for the people who think that Creole features are uniform, that there is such a thing as a Creole language type, they would say that the typical thing about that language type is very, very little morphology. And by that definition, Old English would have too much morphology to be a Creole in the classical definition. If it were a Creole, it would have to be a Creole with Celtic, right? But I think it's probably not plausible to say that Old English was a Creole simply because it has too much in the way of morphology.
Yeah, going back to the last slide, how can we see if the word
comes from Latin or Anglo-Norman?
I think you had the example of
Cosmo,
where you said it's Anglo-Norman.
Right, yeah, that one was a bit mean, actually, and I don't plan to put anything that mean on the actual exam. I won't give you an example that doesn't have any specific sort of. So first of all, there are two ways that I might give you a question like that. One is if we've actually talked about that particular example on the slides, right? So if I've said this word comes from, you know, if I've discussed it in detail, right? So not just like randomly at the bottom of a table somewhere, but if I've actually discussed a word and its origins in the lectures, then I might ask you about it in the exam. The other thing is if it exhibits a linguistic property that can only be from that particular language. So for instance, if a word begins with sk, you can be fairly clear that it's a word from Norse. It's very, very likely. Similarly, there are certain suffixes that suggest very strongly that a word is from Anglo-Norman. Suffixes that end in "-ons", and things like that. So if you get a question about a lexical borrowing, it will be a question like that. The one I gave you on the practice exam, like I said, was a little bit on the mean side, even though we did talk about it on the lecture slide. Any other questions? Okay, so moving on now to prescriptivism and standardization. This shouldn't need much revision because we talked about it literally last week, but it's important as a general property of the history of English, and it's important when you compare English to other languages, particularly other Western European languages. What's important particularly is that before the early modern period, it doesn't make sense to speak of a linguistic standard of the kind that we have today. For instance, in West Saxon Old English, there was no standard in this modern sense, right? There was no sort of set of norms that everyone felt themselves forced to apply to. There is, in the sense that the monks, the people who were writing in English, did have norms, right? They had the individual scriptoria that they were writing in would have had certain ways in which English was typically written. But this isn't full standardization. It's not full standardization because we don't see all four of these processes that are listed at the bottom of the slide here, these key processes that have to take place for standardization. What's also important is that the kind of prescriptivism that we see today is largely an artifact of the 17th century and beyond. Right? This is again tied up with political and ideological decisions that people have made, that the countries have made. That's not to say that people didn't judge other people based on the linguistic variants they use. Recently, it's been in the news that one of the English politicians, Angela Rayner, has been being attacked on Twitter because of her non-standard pronunciation. And this, you know, this is a classic. If you don't like someone, then you criticize the way they talk. Right? It's an easy target. It's a bit like saying, you know, ha, 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 you're really short, or ha, 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 you're really fat, or ha, 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 your skin color is really weird. You know, language is just another way of judging people. And that level of discrimination has presumably always existed. Right? Specifically, the people who've been attacking Angela Rayner for her attitudes are people who don't like her because they have different political views. But the particular modern kind of standardization of, you know, we should speak the Queen's English as it is written down in the Oxford English Dictionary, that kind of prescriptivism is a rather modern invention. When we talk about standardization, we want to talk about these four processes. So selection, elaboration, codification, and acceptance. Selection means picking out a variety. In this case, the variety of the London Chancery, which has its roots in the East Midlands, ultimately. Elaboration means giving your language the resources it needs to perform all possible purposes. So elaboration, in the context of English, involves bringing in a lot of words from Latin and from Greek, and also from French, in specific domains. Codification, then, is writing grammars and dictionaries. You know, if you want to codify a language, it has to be written down. We have to know exactly how it's used. This is the main step we don't have in the Old English period, for instance. We do not have Old English dictionaries or grammars. So in that sense, standardization is incomplete. Also, acceptance. It's broadly accepted by the population, though not always willingly, that there is a right and a wrong way to speak. And that is the essence of acceptance as the final stage of standardization. And again, it's far from clear that this would have been true in the Old English period, when there was much more variability, even in the written texts. Any questions? So then one big question is, does this kind of prescriptivism lead to language change? Do we get language change that arises because of prescriptivism? Well, prescriptivism certainly does affect what people write. So if we look, for instance, during the modern English period at preposition stranding, and remember when we talked about preposition stranding, we saw that it was very, very old. We saw that it goes back as far as Old English in some instances. So it's nothing new, but it does decline in written texts during the modern English period. We get less preposition stranding. We get more sentences of the type, with whom were you speaking? And fewer sentences of the type, who were you speaking with? Whether this really affects speakers' natural usage or their mental grammars, what they have in their heads, is much less clear. We certainly, you know, the prescriptive forces against preposition stranding have not been successful in removing preposition stranding from the language. People still do it all the time, all over the place. So So prescriptivism isn't always successful in achieving its stated aims. Similarly, you know, if people try and get rid of words from the language, like the quotative like, they're not always successful in doing so. They can try. They can write angry letters to the newspapers. They can shout on the radio about how important it is that we go back to the old days. But we can't guarantee that they will be successful. In fact, a typical way of putting this is that language change is like a big flowing river. And if we try and block that river, we're fairly unlikely to be successful. Right? We have to put in some serious effort to dam a river. And eventually, if we leave the dam alone, it will just get washed away by the river anyway. So this is often a metaphor used for the effects of prescriptivism. One thing that's important to note is that the effects of prescriptivism might not always be the intended ones. So sometimes there can be effects of prescriptivism that were not the ones that the prescribers really wanted. And to read about those, I would suggest looking at this book by Ann Curzon called Fixing English, which is a very nice treatment, very accessible treatment of attempts to prescribe and proscribe usage in the history of English. Now, last time, I got a little bit evangelical about your role as teachers of English and future citizens of the world. And I won't revisit that, but I will say, as you can see, that the future of the English language is in your hands. You are speakers of English, users of English, and what happens to it in the future is not just up to me and other posh male white people, okay? It's up to everyone who speaks it. Right, are there any general questions at this stage? All right, we will move on to just a little bit. Yeah, sorry. Sorry? More marked exam questions. So I've posted the answers to the sample exam online. I don't know if you've all seen those. I only posted them yesterday evening. So you can get the answers to the sample exam questions to compare. Try it first on your own and then look at the answers. Don't just read the answers. That's pointless. I'm going to ask you different questions this time. What you want to know is how well you're likely to perform on this random on a random set of these questions. So there are 36 nice answered questions available for you online. And if you want any more, well, no. Sorry, you can't have them. That's just selfish, right? It takes me a while to write these questions. So yeah, I think you're already getting the fairly good end of the deal there. Any other questions? Right, so what resources do you have to revise from? Obviously, you have the lecture slides, you have the lecture recordings. The lecture slides you can grab off Ilias, the lecture recordings are on the streaming server. Thank you very much to the streaming team. Can we have a hand for the people who've been recording? So, wonderful, thank you very much. There's also a textbook. You can look at the textbook, you can read the textbook, you can enjoy the pretty pictures and diagrams, and you can improve your mental capacities through the study of the historical English language through reading Van Gelderen 2014. You've got a sample exam, which I just mentioned. You've got all kind of resources that you can find on the web. If what we've presented in the other resources isn't enough for you, there are literally dozens of different History of English textbooks out there. There are all kinds of bits and pieces on Wikipedia, on Wiktionary, on the OED. You will need to use your discretion with these resources because some of them are rubbish and some of them are brilliant. But now that you've studied a course on the history of the English language, you will have a better idea which is which. Finally, of course, you have your wonderful tutors here at the front. And you have me, and we are here to help. Your tutors and I are there to help. Me and your tutors are there to help. My office hours, just a reminder, are Tuesday 2 till 3 and Wednesday 10 to 11. You might want to get there early. It might get a little bit busy this week, I'm not sure. If you ask questions that I deem to be either stupid or too hard, I will not respond to them by email, right? Email, easy questions only. Otherwise, come and see me, right? If you want to ask me a stupid question in particular, come and see me, because I'm too polite to laugh in your face. All right, any questions about the practicalities? Right, here I just thought we could discuss for a little bit. Here are a few little texts, and try and pick out interesting things that are going on in these texts. This is a translation of a text, which is actually a Latin text, Boethius, from the early first millennium AD. And the reason it's interesting from our perspective is that there are many different translations of it throughout the history of the language. So we can compare the Old English with the Middle English to the early modern English. Lots of people had a crack at this. King Alfred got this translated. Whether he did it himself, not so clear. As is traditionally assumed, King Alfred wrote everything. More recent scholarship suggests that actually he had a team of people who did it all for him, and then he just stuck his name on the end. So he did it. Geoffrey Chaucer had a go at translating this text. And Queen Elizabeth I, one of the sort of really iconic figures in the history of England, here she is, she also translated this text. And it does look like she actually did do it herself, right? Though she did have someone, an amanuensis, to help her with the actual writing. Let's have a look at this text. We've got a modern English translation here of this little passage. And here we've got Queen Elizabeth's version. So what is interesting about the Queen Elizabeth version? What is different? What can you tell me? Can be very simple things. Yes. Yes. Thou. Yes. Or probably in the language of the time, thou. So this, instead of having just in remember in modern English in the second person, regardless of the number, regardless of the case, it's just you. In early modern English and before, you have this thou or thou form. Cognate with German du, and having many of the same functions. It's a singular form. Yes?
You still have a suffix on the thing.
Yes. Yes, we still have a second person singular suffix on think. So, if thou thinkest, this is a very specific suffix. We find it in many Germanic languages, West Germanic languages at least, this st suffix, which is lost in modern English. So we see more verbal agreement than we would otherwise have seen. We also see some other forms that you might not necessarily expect in the modern language, like art. Thou art. This means you are. Right? This art form is a second person singular form, and when thou disappears, this art form also disappears. What else is interesting about this text? Yeah.
The words forward and rather in the first translation, I can't figure out what they're doing.
Yeah, this gave me a headache when I first looked at it. I was like, what? I think that actually what's confusing here is that Elizabeth spells the, which is the accusative singular form, the, right? So it looks like a definite article. in this text, but it's actually, not accusative singular. Well, we don't really know at this point. It's non-nominative. That's the crucial point. So this is the, right? So toward is working as a preposition there. And then rather is just an adverb. But that's probably the single most confusing part of this passage. When I first saw this in the text, I was like, what the hell? And then eventually I figured it out, because she uses the like this in other forms as well.
I didn't realize that those were both spelling issues, but then there's clearly some regular spelling issues in general, you or the special.
Yeah. Good spot again. Are there any V's in this text at all? I can't see any, but if I've missed one, it's just through omission. What you see is that you is used where we'd use a V today. So ever is ever. It wasn't pronounced that way. The thing was, in these texts, you and V were not different. They were. You can think of them as different allographs of the same grapheme, right? You use V at the beginning of a word, and then you use you in any other position. And here we don't have any V's because we don't have any words that would start with you or V. So that's one of the differences. Anything else to note? Yep. Yeah. These are a little tricky ones. Deceived. Yeah. We still have this in the English language, but it's rather archaic now. So this is a lexical term that's sort of gone out of favor. But it's a borrowing from French ultimately. I wouldn't expect you to know that in the exam, in case you're worrying. On the other hand, this one down here. Mutability. This suffix, ability, right? This is something. This is one of those pieces of derivational morphology that is an indication that you're dealing with something that comes from French. So this is the kind of thing that I might expect you to be able to spot, right? These ability endings, which we can also still see in the modern language. Anything else? One more thing that I would like to point out, the use of the perfect tense is not quite as widespread as it is today. So, for instance, here we have, this was ever her manner, this was her nature. And this is used for a continuing state that also held in the past. Today we would say, this has always been her nature. But in this earlier text, it's this was her nature. This was ever. This was always her nature. So the use of the perfect is not as widespread. Even in this quite late period, remember one of the big differences between modern English and early modern English is precisely this. It's the use of auxiliaries is not quite as widespread in this earlier period. Okay, enough of early modern English. We will go back in time. So now we've got Chaucer. Tell me things about this text. Yes.
We have a couple of vowel
Yes, both actually are. It's difficult to tell why Chaucer uses this word rather than the other word in this particular instance. But yes, this verb, you get this verb weinan, to think. So that's one thing that sets apart sets this apart from modern English. Interesting thing there. Anything else? Yes. There is a subject, but not the one you, not it doesn't look like anything we have today. So it's a good observation. The subject here is though, which means those. It's like tha in in Old English, sorry. And ben here is a plural form of to be. What about word order? Can you see anything interesting about the word order in this text? Yes. It is verb second. It's also subject verb, so we wouldn't particularly expect it to be any different in modern English, right? But yes, it's verb second. Good. Anything else? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So here we've got a subordinate clause, and remember that in Old and Middle English, in subordinate clauses, verb second does not apply. And so just like in German, you might be expecting the verb to follow the object in a sentence like this, and that's exactly what we find. If you that think, meaning if you think that. So the object here is that, and it's before the verb win. Anything else on this text? All right, let us take our final skip back in time to the Alfredian translation. Can you tell me anything about this text? If anyone says that there is a thorn in this text, I will literally kill you. But anything other than that, or an eth or an ash, right? I can't deal with that. Yes. Yeah. So as German speakers, you recognize this sort of root, Wandlung. So change is a word that's borrowed from French again, so or Anglo-Norman very early. So in Chaucer, we see it written with the Anglo-Norman spelling, change. Interestingly, change. With a Germanic root ing, a Germanic ending ing on it, but in the old, oops, in this example we see Wandlunge, we see changes being used in the used. With a sort of an old-fashioned Germanic root in this style. Anything else to see? Yeah? Yep. So there's some nice examples of case here. So we've got thu as a beautiful instance of second person singular nominative, the as the dative counterpart. Why is this the dative? So why is, yes. Yeah, it's an on preposition. So the preposition on, this is like in German, in would take the dative case in its complement. In dem Haus, im Haus, right? This would be something like in dir, right? This is a preposition that simply takes the dative case in its complement. Good. So we can see the case system in action here. What can we say about this word here, theawas? Specifically, the end. We can actually tell a few things about this ending, because this as ending, as, is something that we only find particularly, we only find it in the nominative and accusative plural of masculine and neuter nouns. Again, you're not going to be expected to know this off the top of your head, but this is the kind of thing that if you have the paradigms in front of you, you can look up, you can see, where is this as ending? What does it mean? And that we can tell something about the word theos. We can at least narrow down what person and number, we can narrow down that it's plural, for instance. We know that it's plural. We also know that it's not feminine. We can tell that it's either masculine or neuter. That kind of thing. So that's on the morphological level. You also see that in this sentence, von tu on jedwolan. What's going on with the word order in this clause? The phrase you're looking for starts with verb and ends with second, okay? This is a verb second clause. You have subject verb inversion because you have thonne, then, at, art. Remember we saw this in Elizabeth too. She uses the form art, second person singular. And then thu, the subject, is after the verb. So we've got subject verb inversion. What else can we say about this word ert? What phonological change can you see in this word? One that we discussed in the lectures. Yes. Breaking, yes. So when you get these diphthongs, this EA diphthong, it happens before certain consonants. One of them is an R. So you can see that this is a context for breaking. And there are a few other, I was going to say there are a few other examples of breaking. Yes, there are. There are one or two. For instance, beheldon. This eo is also a diphthong caused by breaking. One other thing here, this he, also here, he, this is plural. We can tell that it's plural because of the verb that agrees with it. Beheldon, right? This is a past plural form. And again, if you have the paradigms, you can check this for yourself. So this shows that this is he being used in the third person plural. And this is something special about Old English, remember, because this in Old English, this is before the pronouns they, them, and their were introduced. So this special third person plural, he, is found a couple of times. And you'll know that there's spelling variation. So up here it's he with an I, down here it's he with a Y. This probably doesn't have any phonological correlate, but we can't be sure. Any other points that people want to raise about this text? Good, okay. I don't have a summary today because that would entail summarizing the entire course, and you can do that for yourself. In fact, there's a nice task. Write a nice little summary if you want. But what you need to do is revise. So, next week there will be an exam. As I said, You need to come, you need to be on time because we're going to start at 10 o'clock. No latecomers, no stragglers. You've got various materials you can use. Please bring your Ausweis, your card, right? So that, and put it on the table in front of you so that we can see who you are. And you'll need to put your number, your student number, on the front of the exam script. Are there any other final questions? Well, if not, I will bid you farewell. That's the end of this lecture series. Thank you very much for your patience and attention.